Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Folklore, a podcast channel on New Books Network. I'm Nancy Ann, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I will be talking with David Todd Lawrence and Elaine Lawless, authors of When They Blew the Levee, Race, Politics, and Community in Pinhump, Missouri, which is an ethnography of a rural African-American town that was destroyed when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made the decision to breach the Birds Point Levee in the historic flood of 2011. David Todd Lawrence is an associate professor who teaches folklore and African-American literature and culture at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Elaine Lawless is professor emerita at the University of Missouri, where she taught folklore and women's and gender study. Welcome, Todd. Welcome, Elaine, to the New Books and Folklore podcast.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
First of all, I want to thank you both for your work in writing this book, for putting into print the testimonies of the residents of Pinhope, Missouri, who resisted racial, community, and physical erasure in the face of destruction of their town. It's quite a powerful book, and it won the 2019 Chicago Prize for Excellence in Folklore Scholarship. But before we head into talking about Pinhook, I'm wondering if you could tell me about how you came to folklore. What's your folklore origin story? So, Elaine, I'm going to start with you because you're the senior scholar among us.
Okay. So I have always been an English major in college and then in graduate school when I got my master's at University of Illinois. And I wasn't happy in English. It seemed like an awful lot of work reading dead white guys. And it was really separate from real people. And so I was fortunate enough to have two folklorists as teachers at Illinois. One was Archie Green, who became very well known in our field as a lobbyist for the American Folklife Center and a ballad scholar. He's a wonderful human being. So I was in his classes, and also a very young professor, Larry Danielson, who was teaching folklore courses at Illinois at that time. And they both really inspired me to think about folklore as a major for my PhD. I had also taught at Yale for a year with Bill Ferris, who's very well known in folklore, Mississippi scholar. And I went to him just to sit in on his classes, but I ended up being his TA for some courses, and that sealed the deal. So I applied to graduate studies in folklore and went to Indiana, which of course is Mecca for folklore, or it was then. I went there in 1977, and I think there were 33 folklore grad students in the PhD program that year. Many of them are still active folklorists today. It was an amazing class, and it was a great place to be for folklore. So my first job in folklore after I got the PhD was at the University of Missouri. And I had been born in Missouri. I didn't think I'd ever go back to Missouri. It wasn't a place that was very progressive. But the university was a wonderful place to be to teach folklore. And When Anand Prahlad came to Missouri, he and I together really worked hard to build a folklore program. It was within English, but students could get a PhD in folklore with us. And I never looked back. It's been great.
Okay, wow. Thanks for sharing that. How about you, Todd?
I'm just sort of like amazed that Elaine's story is like so perfectly told. I don't know if I could match that. I think my story is just sort of more falling into things. You know, I also started off as an English major as an undergraduate at Rockhurst University, which is in Kansas City. And I did an MA at Creighton University in Omaha, and I studied American realism there with a scholar called Greg Zacharias. Is one of the really great teachers that I've had in my life. He really influenced me a lot, and that's part of why I decided to go to the University of Missouri. In the beginning, I was going to study American realism at the University of Missouri, but when I got there, I think I always had this sort of underlying interest in African American literature and culture. And I got there and I sort of fell into folklore. There were students there, you know, there was a program there that was really vibrant. And those students in that program were really, they were fun. They were studying really interesting things. And they started sort of inviting me to gatherings and, you know, come over to Elaine's house and things like that. And then I eventually took a class with Elaine. And I think it was feminist ethnography, maybe. I think maybe it was the class. And the people in that class, you know, were the sort of core of the folklore cohort at the time. And they all became really good friends of mine. And I still, you know, I'm in touch with them today. And a lot of them have jobs in, you know, folklore and public sector and in academia and other places. So for me, it was about sort of finding a place where I could do the kind of work that I wanted to do. I was really interested in African-American music. I was interested in Rastafari religious belief and tradition. And so it was sort of perfect for me with Elaine and Prahlad there. And it just felt like it was sort of the first time where I really felt like nurtured as a person, as in addition to, you know, as a sort of scholar in training. And I felt like people were, if I said, I'd like to do this, they said, okay, let's do that, you know? So that was really a great feeling. And I haven't had that very many other places in my career, but that was always one place that I can look back to and feel like I felt I was in the right place at the right time with the right people. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to say, you know, the field is really lucky to have both of you and to have both of you stay in the field for so long. I mean, you know, both of you are doing really interesting work and, you know, which leads us into the book, When They Blew the Levee, which is really a fantastic read. I mean, it was really gripping. I'd like to start talking about the book with a quote. You write that your book, quote, focuses on two conflicting narratives about the flood of 2011, one promoted by the Army Corps of Engineers that boasts the success of the breach of the levees and the diversion of the flooding waters according to plan, and the other gleaned from oral narratives we heard from displaced residents of the town of Pinhook. So can you talk a little bit about what happened to the town of Pinhook and what are the two competing narratives?
Sure.
So either of you.
Okay, you want me to take that, Elaine?
Oh, sure. If you get it wrong, I'll correct you. How's that?
This is how we work. So.
All right, sounds great.
That's a joke, Nancy. That's a joke. I would never correct Todd ever.
Well, it's pretty true that we correct
each
other.
Yes, I would.
We learned how to be partners. You know, that's one thing maybe we'll talk about with regard to this mm-hmm. book is that when you work okay. together, you have to learn how to be partners and how to, you know, I don't know if correct's the right word, but like, you know, respond to what each other think and are doing and negotiate yeah. some of that stuff. So
yeah. Question.
But anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go for it.
But yeah. So anyway, so the story of the disaster, the displacement of Pinhook people It's May 2011. Really, the, I guess it starts that spring with a lots and lots and lots of snow and precipitation, and there's a huge flood that happens specifically in the along the Mississippi River, but also the Missouri River and the Ohio rivers. It's basically that whole system. It's a 1,000-year flood, basically. And the people of Pinhook, the town is located inside of a floodway, the Birds Point New Madrid floodway. And the floodway is part of the Mississippi River and tributary system, which is a kind of flood mitigation system. It's designed to basically divert water from the Mississippi River to make the river level go down. And it had only been operated one time in, I think, in 1937. So that was even before anybody who, you know, currently lived at Pinhook at the time, any of their ancestors had come there. So most of the people who came and sort of founded Pinhook came in the early 1940s. So I don't think that they had any sort of expectation that this floodway would be operated. So the flooding got worse and worse and worse and worse. And eventually the Army Corps of Engineers operated the system, as they say, which meant they blew a giant hole in the front side levee and let lots and lots and lots of water flood 130,000 acres of land, which in the middle the town of Pinhook sat. And maybe the most sort of terrible thing about all of it was that the people of Pinhook were really not effectively notified that this was going to happen. Deborah Robinson, who's our sort of closest collaborator on this project, she's like the mayor of Pinhook. She's referred to that way. You know, she told us, and many other people told us, they never got an official notification that this was going to happen. They were basically, you know, trying to find out, are they going to blow the levee? Are they not going to blow the levee? What's going to happen? And by the time they had a pretty good idea that that was probably going to happen, it was really too late for them to evacuate their belongings out of their town. And so they only had about less than 24 hours to do that. And so they didn't get much of their stuff at all. So they had to basically leave their lives behind. They didn't get any help in evacuating. They had trouble finding trucks, you know, all that stuff. And so they were dispersed in a lot of different places, some nearby, some far away as Kansas City and Chicago, St. Louis. So it was a real, you know, disaster for their community. But I think, you know, the book is a lot about how they maintained community in spite of being in all these different places because of what happened to them. And I think, you know, to talk about the narratives, I mean, the narrative of the Army Corps of Engineers was essentially that they did what they had to do. They followed the procedures for the Missouri, you know, river and tributary system. And also that they basically saved, you know, so much farmland by doing what they did. The account, one of the accounts of the flood is called, what's the name of that book, Elaine? Do you remember?
I was just thinking it's called Divine Providence.
Yeah, that's it. Divine Providence. Yeah.
Right.
So that's kind of the way that they, you know, sort of cast their role in this as the almost like the hand of God, you know, saving this farmland and saving other towns. Meanwhile, they had destroyed Pinhook so that it was no longer habitable. So the story that the Pinhook people told to us was very much in contrast to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was really struck by how it seemed that they had forgotten that or didn't know that the town of Pinhook existed. And this act that, you know, supposed to be so helpful and save so, you know, that was such a great thing. In this act, they left out these, you know, the small town, you know. And so it reminds me of what of another thing that you said in the book, where you say that racism is systemic, even necessary to maintain the fabric of life enjoyed by most white Americans. And then a little bit further in the book, you say that for those in power, the African-American community was invisible, unimportant, and dispensable. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, because that definitely seemed like the case here. You know, on one hand, they saved all these, you know, they saved all this, but what was the cost in that process? So in what ways was Pinhook an example of the systemic racism that you were talking about?
Do you want to take that one, Elaine?
Oh, no, you're doing really well. No, keep going. I'll add something, but go ahead.
Okay.
You're on a roll.
Well, I think, you know, that's a big, that whole question is something that we really grapple with in the book, because, you know, when we first started the project, Elaine came to me and, you know, we were at AFS actually in Bloomington. And she said, I want to talk to you about something. And we talked and she told me about Pinhook. Pinhook is located very close to where she grew up in Southeast Missouri, in the Boot Hill, Missouri. And essentially the question she was saying is, I want to find out how this could have happened. And that became a really, I think, important animating question for the project over, you know, almost 10 years. We've been still writing about the people of Pinhook. How could this have happened to them? How could they have been invisible? How could they have been ignored? All these sorts of things. And what we found, you know, certainly not so much in the story that they told us. I mean, they were really reluctant to say things like, this is because of racism, or this happened because we were Black, or because our town is a Black town. But it became pretty obvious to us, you know, over the course of doing the research that essentially they had been, you know, erased. We interviewed there was a lawsuit by the state of Missouri against the Army Corps of Engineers, against the federal government, to try to stop them from operating the floodway. And we interviewed the judge who essentially allowed that to go on. And we asked him, you know, like, well, was there discussion about Pinhook during the deliberations, like, you know, the arguments about this? And he said, oh, yeah, sure there was, yeah. And he was looking through his notes and in the documents from the case, and he couldn't find anything. And there really wasn't. And they actually, you know, he gave us the pile of documents, everything they had from the case, and we went through it page by page by page, and we didn't find any testimony where anyone mentioned Pinhook at all. And you got to be thinking, how can they make a decision like this when there's a town of people living in the middle of this floodway and nobody ever mentions it, nobody ever talks about it? And that, you know, that was really shocking to us. And so we were thinking a lot about how, you know, Black people in general become, you know, suffer from erasure, but in particular because this is a rural area where this took place, and essentially a place where Black people are not supposed to be, that they're sort of doubly erased, and were doubly erased in this case. And so that's one of the things that we talk about a lot in the book. But I mean, it's still shocking when I think about it now, you know, the question of how could this have happened? And yet at the same time, it's not surprising, because this is the sort of thing that happens to people of color all over this country. And that's one of the things, like, Elaine, you probably remember, like, every time we went and gave a talk somewhere about Pinhook, someone would come up to us afterwards and say, did you know about this town? And it would be like indigenous people, it would be like Latinx people, it would be, you know, they would always be people of color, towns where people of color lived, and something had happened to destroy their town. It wasn't, you know, this one-off kind of incident. It was happening many, many times in history, you know. So, you know, in a way it's shocking, but we shouldn't be surprised.
And so Pinhook is, Pinhook is symbolic of many towns in the United States, small rural people of color that are seen as expendable in the larger scheme of things, or according to the American government. Right. I'm sorry, Elaine, you were going to say something.
Too. And I just wanted to say that in working with Todd, which has been fantastic, you talked about having a partnership. I had never done research before in my life, well, I did in grad school, but after that, never had a partner. And so working with someone else on this topic, we really did bring different things to the project. And I remember when Todd, we were sitting in the car in the parking lot of the destroyed church, and we were both taking notes on our computers. And you started talking about urban normativity. And I'm like, what are you talking about? But it made sense because the way you were framing it is that with the migration of many Blacks from the South to the North, that was something that people knew about. That was a migration people knew about. And in fact, for a lot of people, the association of Black with urban centers is kind of normal now, right? And so you start talking about why it was so weird that it was easy to erase these Black farmers, because that's not where we thought migrating Blacks landed, right? So that got us to go into the history more and find out that a lot of Black people who were moving from the South actually didn't want to live in the urban North. They actually loved working with the soil, and they wanted to own their own land. And then that revealed that the only land available to them in Missouri, at least, was this land that essentially was in the spillway. And that everybody knew when they bought that land that it could be flooded, except historically they kind of forgot that, or their ancestors didn't even know that, you know, the land technically was in the spillway. But I remember us talking about how one of the reasons why it was possible for this town to be ignored. And it, as far as I know, Pinhook may still be on maps of Missouri. In 2011, it was absolutely a town on the maps in Missouri. So for people to ignore that and to say, oh, we didn't even know those people were down there, just isn't true. So, yeah, I think that was definitely one of our questions, like, how could this happen? And I think in the last year or two, issues of race in this country have made it possible for us to reframe some of our thinking and our expectations there. So I just wanted to add that.
So both of you mentioned that it was very clear that it was an issue of racism, or systemic racism. But Todd, you also mentioned that the the residents, such as Robinson, she seemed reluctant, or she didn't explicitly state that, or she didn't think that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that she didn't think that. I would say that they were really careful not to say that and not to make their case that they were making about that. And I think, looking back on it, I think it is sort of like one of those cases of sort of almost like stereotype threat, you know, where they were sensitive to being seen as, you know, sort of angry Black women, you know, sort of, going to racism as the first, the major reason why they're, making their case. And they were really, really conscious of how they were being seen as they were making their appeal, that their town should be, they should be given money and allowed to rebuild their town. In some ways, it's like a sort of rhetorical move, right? They're aware of who their audience was. The people who were in power were white people, right? And they didn't want to be seen as accusing those white people of being racist because they didn't think that would help them. We did talk to some other people, mostly men, and this was sort of, sometimes it was like kind of after we'd sort of finished the book, or towards the end of the book, but sometimes men who didn't want, they didn't talk to us when we were kind of in the main gathering, phase of the book, we'd end up like just sort of chatting with them, and they would say, well, you don't want to talk to me because I'll tell you the truth or something like that. Right. And we started to see that, okay, it's not that that understanding of the situation wasn't there. I mean, they're not stupid. I mean, they're smart people, they knew what was going on, but they also saw like this wouldn't be in their benefit to make that a part of the case, you know.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense. Right.
Even today, yeah. I mean, if we had this conversation, and we have had conversations with them post book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we have tried to make, Todd and I have been pretty stubborn about holding to our view that this is systemic racism, and they have every right to speak out. And they are very cautious to this day. I remember a couple of years ago, we were at a Pinhook gathering, and we were talking about race relations and, I don't know, the president and various things. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, how do you feel about race relations in the country now and how Black people are treated? And I don't remember what the president's doing. I don't remember exactly what I said. And she said, oh, I'm going to pray for him. That's what I'm going to do. And I thought, oh my God. But that's really typical of her. It was just, even to this day, they're not going to speak openly about how they're feeling because, yeah, Todd's right. It's a rhetorical move. They know exactly what they're doing. And it's gendered. There is a whole chapter in the book about women being the leaders and the ones who filed all the paperwork and went to meetings where they were treated poorly. And the gender thing was very prominent. And that was strategic also, you know, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And they hoped that what they did would improve the situation for them. And in some respects, eventually it kind of did. A few of them got houses way later, but it didn't really solve the problem. And certainly no one in the government came back and said, this shouldn't have happened. No one has ever said that after the fact. Mm-hmm. Never. You know, they're right.
Mm-hmm. And they probably won't.
Nope.
In a way, I mean, this is something we've written about since the book.
Right.
The fact that they got houses, which this happened in 2018, the spring of 2018, there was a community development block grant, I think that came from the state of Missouri, but it wasn't enough to build 9 houses, which is how many they built. It took Mennonite Disaster Services and to come on board. There was help from Catholic charities, volunteer labor, Amish labor from Ohio, a lot of donated building supplies and things like that to be able to build those houses. And like that was a happy thing, you know. I mean, now, Deborah and her sister Twan and her mother and, 4 or 5 other people have houses to live in. But it really let the federal government off the hook, right? Because now they have houses. There's nothing really left to complain about. And so, in some ways, the case is shut. We've sort of been pushing back and keep pushing back. I mean, I actually talked to Deborah on the phone the other day and Tuan on text. And I was sort of saying to them, people are still asking us to talk about what happened to you. And early on when we first started, when we would go and talk about things at conferences or something like that, we would try to bring them with us if we could, or to have them speak for themselves. And I was sort of saying to them, would you guys still like to do that? Because I mean, Zoom, you wouldn't have to travel or anything. We could, set it up so that you could show up and talk for yourself. And they both said, we're glad people are still interested, but it's time for us to move on. We had to get on with our lives. And so they're basically done. So the fact that they have something is enough to kind of like, well, we're done. It's time to move on. They're not going to keep, pushing this. It's sort of us that are left to continue to tell this story. And I think they've given us permission to continue to do it. And they've recognized that some of the things that we say are different from from the way that they would say it. And we've talked to them about it, and they sort of said, okay, well, this is, you go ahead and say what you need to say, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least you have this historical record of this town, because even though the residents, they got some houses, individual houses, but the town isn't replaced, right? So, you know, it leads me into my other question, which is, you know, wanting to find out more about the history of Pinhook. Here you have a rural African-American town. And, you know, as we mentioned before, this Pinhook is probably one of many towns that are also small and unnoticed. But I'd like to hear you say a little bit more about how Pinhook began.
Yeah.
And what was it like, and what it was like to live in Pinhook?
Yeah, well, we have a whole chapter. I think that's the first chapter in the book, right? And I think that was, you know, we were really intentional about that, that once we started working on the project, which initially was about a disaster, we started to see pretty quickly that, well, really the real story here is about a community. And that meant we wanted to really talk about how they saw their community, because we would talk to all these people and they would talk about this place that they had lived and how beautiful it was and how safe it was and how connected they felt to each other and all these sorts of things. You know, there was, I think there was a Mr. Williams, that he was the one person who was like, it was hard to live out there, but most everybody else, you know, they acknowledged that it was hard work and farming was hard work and all that, but that generally speaking, they really loved living out there. And it, you know, it basically in the early 1940s, the story that we heard from several people was that there were five men who came from Tennessee looking to buy land to farm and start a community farm for themselves. And they came to the Boot Heel, and this was the land that was available to them. It was inside of the floodway. It was land that nobody really wanted, and therefore it was available to them, these black men, to buy in the early 1940s. It wasn't illegal at the time for black people to buy land, but in practice, it was difficult for black people to buy land, almost impossible for black people to buy land at the time. So they really had to come upon the right situation with a person willing to sell. And that's what happened. And so they, you know, bought this land, sort of divided it up amongst themselves. Then other people came, they invited, you know, told their families, that sort of stuff. And the town grew and grew and grew. And from, you know, what we understood from the stories, it was a very, you know, like a bustling town with a church and, you know, like a sort of, there were stores. I think there was maybe even a movie theater. I mean, there were all, you know, all the sort of, things that you would find in a small town. And I think technically it was considered a village. So it was under 500 people, even at its height. But it was like a, you know, it was a prosperous place. I think they might've thought of themselves as, you know, struggling or poor or something like that. But also they were successful farmers. They struggled against the land. They struggled against, you know, the flooding that happened every year. It wasn't, you know, just sort of like you wake up every morning and crops are growing out of the ground. It was work. But those are sort of the ways that they talked about it. Hard work, but also a place where they could be safe, a place where they could be with their relatives and friends, their community, place where they could worship and have their own church. Those are the ways that they talked about it. And, you know, it was really, I think, interesting and appealing for us to hear those stories. And we just kept hearing them again and again and again and again about this kind of this way of life that was, you know, destroyed at that place, you know, by the Army Corps of Engineers and on in May of 2011.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, I really, oh, okay. Go ahead, Elaine. Go ahead.
I really like what Todd said, that it was the disaster that caught our attention. But as we worked on this project, it became clear that there was so much more going on here than just the disaster, that it just, it expanded as we learned the story of Pinhook. And one of the reasons that we wanted to use the subtitle where we say race, politics, and community is that all those factors came into being as we worked on the project. So that, to go back to something you said earlier, there were some houses built in 2018, as Todd was saying, but they're not where Pinhook lived. It's not on that same land. on streets in Sykeston, Missouri, the furthest streets from the town center. In fact, in areas that were cotton fields, and those houses are tiny tract houses that the Amish built for them. They're tiny. And to go back and look at photographs and listen to them talk about, say, Aretha's house, who she's the matriarch. I think it was a 5-bedroom house, and it had a patio in the back, and it was on this land, and they built this arbor. The contrast between what they had out at Pinhook, what they had built themselves, and where they are now. And so it's not only that the houses are not nearly like the houses they had in Pinhook, but what's the saddest for us to watch is that the sense of community can't be there. It is in the people. We heard Tuan talk about that, you know, that whatever Pinhook is now today exists on these tiny streets in Sykeston, but it's something meager compared to what it was in Pinhook. And I don't think, as you're saying, I don't think that Pinhook is that unique. I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years, articles in The Atlantic, in The New Yorker, on small African-American towns in the South and in the Midwest that were successful and built up a community, as Todd was saying, where they could be safe and happy and thrive and actually thrive. And those towns have been erased. In fact, Todd, you come from a town, some of your family comes from a town that similarly has disappeared.
My family's from Pennytown in Missouri, and which is one of a number of Black townships in Saline County, Missouri, in central Missouri. But yeah, I mean, there were small towns like that all over the Midwest. I mean, maybe Nicodemus Kansas is a really pretty well-known example, but Oklahoma had tons and tons of Black townships. And they were these places where Black people could, you know, relatively speaking, feel safe, build a life and a community together, and have their own place. You know, in the case of Pennytown, it thrived for, you know, from 1873 until, or actually 1871, I think, until, you know, the early 1940s. So it was sort of going out of existence at the very time that that Pinhook was coming into existence, right? So I've always sort of thought of, there's kind of like this weird connection between my own sort of family history and the history of this town of Pinhook, which, you know, sort of further connected me to the people there.
And even though the town is not there anymore physically, and all the residents have moved into, you know, the small part of Sykestown, do they still have Pinhook Day? I remember from the book, you know, Pinhook Day is like around Memorial Day, and it's time for everybody to come back together and kind of celebrate the town. And they continued it after the flood. So are they still, now that they've settled into their new homes, are they still continuing with Pinhook Day?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they couldn't have it this past May because of COVID, but they did have it last year, and they had it every year after the flood. One of the things that's really cool is in 2018, when the houses were built, Mennonite Disaster Services also built them a picnic shelter out at the Pinhook land. So they still can, like, Pinhook still technically belongs to them, and they can still be out there. I mean, it's their place. They can't build a habitable dwelling on the land anymore. But this picnic shelter, which is like a 20-by-60-foot picnic shelter, they can, for Pinhook Day, go out there and have a big celebration and fry up fish and all the things that they do for Pinhook Day, which is like, you know, it's a traditional African-American homecoming. It's really important to them. And, you know, I remember that year, 2018, when they were, you know, the first year that they were using the picnic shelter. It doesn't have a concrete base to it. So it's just, you know, sort of a wooden shelter that's anchored into the ground. And Jeff Kohler, I think is his name, who was the project manager, and he's like the director of projects for Mennonite Disaster Services in the western part of the United States. And he was saying to Deborah, well, we could come back and put a concrete floor here. And Deborah said, no, I don't want a concrete floor. I want to be able to take my shoes off and have my feet in the soil of Pinhook. And so they decided right then there would be no floor, that everybody who came there could have their feet right in the ground of Pinhook. And that's super important to them. That place is still important to them, even though they don't live there anymore.
Right. So what happens to the farmland? Is it just land now? Are they farming it, or what's going on with the land itself? Well,
they basically lease it out. So it's being farmed. And there are some people who there's like maybe one or two people. I don't know. I'm kind of like, I'm not 100% positive on how this works, but there's a few people who did live at Pinhook or still farming that land. But I think my understanding was last time we were talking to them, Elaine, am I right? That was basically one person who was kind of like leasing the land,
right?
And doing most of the farming. Is that the way you remember it?
Yeah. I don't know any more about that. No, I don't know anymore.
Okay. I'd like to, talk a little bit more about the process of research. So I know that, you mentioned learning how to have a partner in doing your research. And so I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about that, but also this idea of reciprocal and ethical ethnography. So Elaine, you've written a lot about reciprocal ethnography, where researchers share their work with their collaborators for feedback. And, in a case like this, there's a lot of, you're doing research in a community that has obviously been wronged. So it makes me think about what is the responsibility of a researcher when they, when they do research on a subject like this? Does it stop at just, collecting oral narratives and testimony, which I understand is very important as well, because it is a counter narrative and is a testimony, against erasure. But should and can researchers go beyond that? Did you go and advocate for them, advocate with them? Did you help them navigate the bureaucratic process? So I'm just kind of like thinking out loud about what are the responsibilities of a researcher in cases like these?
Well, those are great questions. And Todd, you answer too, okay? I think I wrote somewhere that reciprocal ethnography is never easy. It sounds good on paper, right? And it does work. In some cases, it works beautifully. And a lot of my work with women ministers, whatever, it worked. But there are big challenges to it too. I mean, I remember when I was working in the shelter, and I'm recording survivor stories, and then I want them to read what I've written and talk to me about it. Well, they didn't have time. I mean, they literally were trying to survive, and they didn't have time to read what I was writing. And so I found other ways to get responses from people who maybe had lived in shelters or worked in shelters to act as sounding boards for what I was thinking and what I was writing. With this project, I remember one time, again, Todd and I were having a conversation, kind of asking the question, is this reciprocal ethnography? And I was feeling like, oh, maybe it's not, because, again, they didn't have time. They really weren't interested in sitting down and reading the chapters that we gave them. And what we had to learn was that they really, as Todd was saying, they came to trust us. And they came to trust that we would both say what they thought needed to be said, but also that we'd find ways to advocate for them based on what we thought. So walking that line was really difficult. We just published an article in Midwestern Magazine called The New Territories. And this was the issue that we wanted to really write about, was how we differed in our approach. And we were more able to show our anger because it wasn't us. And we really were two researchers from universities trying to make sense of all this. But to honor both the way we felt and the way they felt, and to make sure both of those were evident in what we were writing. So it was a constant discussion between us and the community about what needed to be said and how we might say it. We did not go with them and fill out the forms and argue with the whatever entities were being argued with. We didn't think that was our role. They knew what they were doing, and they took care of that stuff. But it was a constant negotiation, and I think your word ethical was something we really tried to keep in mind, was that to be ethical about the way we were presenting the various points of view. Do you want to add to that, Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's everything that you said, I totally agree with. I think, you know, when we first came to the project, when we first met Deborah and her family and Pinhook people, I think we thought, okay, there's something we can bring that will be helpful to them. There's something we can help advocate for them. You know, I think we thought of ourselves that way. But I think we quickly came to see that they were already advocating for themselves. Everything that we thought that we could sort of bring, they were already doing. And things that we wanted to suggest to them were not things that they necessarily wanted to do. And so, I mean, we did what we could with the tools that we had available to us, which was to sort of work with them to try to tell a story that is both about them and is also about us. And I think, you know, that's really important. I mean, that's, you know, I've learned a lot from Elaine over the years as a teacher and as a research partner. One of those things is like, we're in the story. And maybe that's something about, you know, maybe this version of kind of a reciprocal ethnography sort of inspired project was that we tried not to hide from them the way that we were in the story. It was hard sometimes to tell, you know, to tell Tuan or Deborah, like, that's not what I think. And I don't think I'm going to say something different in the book, but I'm going to put what you say, but I'm also going to we're also going to disagree with you or say something in addition, you know, and they would be like, that's okay. We tried to be, you know, open and honest with them. And if I, just to say something about that whole thing of trust, you know, I asked myself, and I think we asked ourselves a lot because, you know, we would go down and do, you know, be with Pinhook people. And then Elaine and I would have a 4-hour drive to get back to where I would usually drop her off at her house or pick up my car there and go on to Kansas City and then back to Minnesota. But so we had a lot of time to talk these things over in detail every time we went down there. And, you know, we were often sort of asking ourselves, like, why would they trust us? Why should they trust us? Maybe they shouldn't trust us. Maybe we're not being completely honest. Maybe this isn't the kind of partnership that we want to think that it is. And over the years, I've sort of understood and heard directly from Deborah that they trusted us because we came back, because we spent time with them over the course of 10 years, you know, and we're still talking to them, you know. I mean, it's not as close, you know, we don't get down there to see them as often, and it'll probably get less and less and less over the years. But there's still a recognition that we have a relationship, and even though it's changing, we still care about them and they still care about us. And that time that we spent together was real and it was valuable and it was genuine. And I think we all recognize that. And I don't really feel now, looking back, that, oh, I was totally taking advantage or anything. I don't feel that way anymore, mainly because Deborah has said, you always came back and we trust you. And that meant everything to us, I think, in this project, was that they felt that way towards us. And we, of course, had a tremendous amount of respect and affection and, you know, everything for them as a real group of people, you know. So it, we felt our responsibility to them was extremely high. Like, we didn't want to get anything wrong. We didn't want to misrepresent anything. We wanted to be honest about our motivations, what we were trying to do, all that kind of stuff. And I hope that the book, you know, sort of reflects that.
Yeah, the book did. I did really enjoy that you inserted yourself in there as researchers, which I appreciate. And because I think that it demonstrates that researchers are not always impartial, you know, all-knowing writers. They have a stake in this too, and you share some of your feelings. And I liked how you kind of switch back and forth about who's asking questions and your reactions. And I thought it was a really interesting study of how research can be done. And you know, and that just made me think about, well, where are the extra steps? Because I also noticed that you created a documentary, and you also created a website for them as well too. And you know. And I guess, Todd, you're maintaining that website.
Yeah, right? I mean, not as much as I used to do. I mean, but definitely maintaining it. And of course, you know, as I said, they're sort of at the point where they're feeling like it's time to move on. So I think now it's more of an archive of the project more than, you know, 7 years ago. It was like a place where people might find out about them. And in fact, you know, I think Jeff Kohler said, you know, the Mennonite Disaster Services guy, that he watched our film on the website to find out more about what had happened, you know. So that was one of the things that we felt good about, because we felt like we tried to do what we knew how to do. And for years, it just didn't seem like it was helping. They were still coming up against, you know, to dead ends and nobody helping them. But when they finally did get this help, you know, some of the stuff that we did played a role in that, and that felt good to know that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to ask you a little bit more about Deborah Robinson, because she's such a key figure. And it really struck me that, you know what, she saved the town. She really saved the town, because she got everybody out even before they got, you know, any kind of official notice. And I like, you know, I mean, because she's such a key central figure, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about, you know, who she is, the kind of person she is, and her role in maintaining community in Pinhook.
Sure. You want to take that one, Elaine?
Well, I can start it. Okay. She is a formidable woman. She is amazing. I don't think I, for one, have never seen a woman so hell-bent on getting something done and so focused on her generosity and her willingness to work. It was just astounding. I mean, we would leave there at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and she would have fed us, and she would have tolerated our questions. And then, you know, I'd find out that she made a huge birthday cake for somebody and took it over to their house and visited somebody else who was sick. And I just don't know where she gets all of her energy, and she's not particularly well all the time, but she's astounding in the amount of energy and generosity that she has. I think other people love the town too, but she really understood the importance of that community to the people who lived there and had raised their kids there. And all the people who had moved away, who would come back every year to homecoming to Pinhook Day. Even if they didn't live there anymore, they had an allegiance to the town. They felt like they were from Pinhook and always would be. And their kids and grandkids would come back. Her mother is Aretha, and she was married to one of the founding fathers, Jim Robinson. And she would do the same thing. Like, she fed everybody. She took care of everybody. She and Jim really were the glue that created that town. And her sister, I mean, it's just an astounding family that held, you know, provided the glue for this particular town. And she always did everything with a great deal of humility. She never did anything to seek attention. She was just generous that way. But people knew, well, still know, that whatever happened with Pinhook was because of Deborah's hard work. She filled out every form. She went to every meeting. Selflessly worked for this. She did save the town when they were trying to get out the flood. And some people would call her the mayor or the manager. And I think over time, they came to understand that she was the point person. If you wanted to find out anything or get anything done, you went to Deborah, that's for sure. But she didn't insist on that. It was only through actions, not with what she called herself or what she did. I remember working on that chapter about the women. I think it may be a stereotype, but it also is flatly true that African-American women have taken on a lot of the work, a lot of the public work. And part of that's to keep the families together, to keep the community together. And this group of women certainly were out in front trying to take care of business and get things done without pissing off a lot of people. I mean, it was really amazing to watch.
Yeah, and I think they were doing it their way. You know, they were doing it their way, and their way was very much informed by their faith.
Yeah.
It was informed by their ancestors. It was informed by the way they thought about their community and the way that they had experienced it, you know, and a desire to preserve that. But yeah, I would just echo everything that Elaine said about Deborah, really an extraordinary person. And I think maybe one thing I would add is that a lot of people told us, you know, that before this happened, Deborah was really quiet and hardly ever spoke. I mean, she wasn't an out front kind of person, but when this happened, she took on the responsibility. And many times when we asked her, you know, why you, why did you do this? And she would basically say, this is what my dad would have wanted me to do. This is what my granddad would have wanted me to do. This is what I'm supposed to do. And so there was this kind of feeling of, you know, like when something needs to be done and you're the one to do it, you do it. And that's what she's done for, you know, for all these years, and that great sacrifice to her, as Elaine said, her health has not always been the best. You know, it's not now, it's suffering a little bit now. And for her personal life and, you know, all these sorts of elements of her life, she sacrificed for this town to, you know, do what she could do. And in the end, even though, you know, we might look at what happened in the end and think like, you know, dang it, that's not what should have happened. None of that would have happened at all if it hadn't been for Deborah and those other women. Work for it.
She sounds definitely like an amazing woman. It came through very clearly in the book. And I noticed, you know, I also noted that she made a quilt of all the houses that were in Pinhook that were destroyed by the flood. And I thought that was pretty extraordinary. I mean, she seems multi-talented. Yeah,
I don't know if she made that quilt. I think somebody else made that quilt, but people contributed to a whole bunch of different.
Oh, did
yeah,
she? Okay.
That was, you know, that's a sort of another aspect of it that, you know, I was talking to someone else about Pinhook the other day. And, you know, another sort of amazing thing is the kind of artwork and sort of material culture that came out of this whole experience, like the kinds of things that they were making, the food and the quilts and the, you know, the art, all the sort of stuff that was generated around this experience that they were all going through as a community was really extraordinary too. And that all connects to, you know, the homecoming as this kind of, you know, sort of vernacular mechanism to hold the community together, even though they'd all been, you know, dispersed to these other places, you know. So that's a fascinating aspect of it too. She's certainly, even if she didn't make that quilt herself, she was right in the middle of it. I can't remember whether or not she made it, but in my mind, I'm thinking that it was another woman that made that quilt. But
well, I think it's still indicative of kind of like the community that she really brought together after the flooding of Pinhook. Well, you know, I feel like there's a lot more I could talk to you about this, but you know, I've already taken a lot of your time. You know, I'd like to ask you one final question that's not related to the book, actually, but what is your next project that you're working on? So, Todd, do you want to start? And then Elaine, you can tell us what your next project is.
Right now, I'm working with a group at the University of St. Thomas. We're called the Urban Art Mapping Project. And we've been working on street art in the Twin Cities, since May, we started the George Floyd and anti-racist street art database. So that's what we're working on right now, which is a archive of images of street art that's been a part of the movement since the murder of George Floyd. And we have an online presence, so you can search George Floyd street art database and you'll find our database. It's available for educational and research purposes. There's about 1,500 records in it right now, and we're still getting more. So if you have an image of anything like a sticker, a tag, a mural that went up in your town over the last few months, if it's on your phone, please send it to us. You can actually upload those images at the website, or you can send it directly to me, and we want to keep adding these images to the database to make sure to preserve what the feelings were, what the response was to this horrible event that took place here in where I am in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area.
That sounds like another incredible project. Elaine, what's your next amazing project that you're working on?
Oh, yeah. So during the pandemic, I actually packed up everything I own and moved to North Carolina. So I don't live in Missouri anymore. And no sooner than I got here, we discovered that the schools were closing. So I have three very small grandchildren in near Raleigh, North Carolina, who are homeschooling. So right now I'm homeschooling children. My daughter's in Holly Springs. I'm helping her homeschool her children. And it's probably the first time in my life I don't have three books on the back burner. It's really nice. I don't even know sometimes to do with myself. When I was still in Missouri, I did start writing a memoir. And I don't know if I want to write this memoir or not, or if I ever want it to see the light of day. But I do continue to play with it. And also when I was in Missouri, I, through friends, became acquainted with a program called, it's a advocates or guardian ad litem. It's a advocacy group for children in court cases where there's been domestic violence or what other abuse, whatever. And I became interested in that because I know someone in the law school there. And so I took the training for this kind of work and then decided I couldn't really start anything if I was going to leave Missouri. So I'm looking into that here. And probably the most interesting research question I've come up with lately has to do with the statistics about the increase in violence and abuse and domestic violence during the pandemic and the effect that that's had on children and families. So I don't know if that will go anywhere. I can't imagine not having a research project going. Again, it's kind of new for me. And I am enjoying not really working hard on something. I've never not worked hard on something. And so this is kind of a breather time for me. But that's one issue that's come to my mind that also crosses with so many of the other issues that I care about human rights and social justice and the lives of women and children and their children. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think this is a great time to take a breather. So I'm looking forward to what comes next. If you decide that you want to put something out there, but I think a breather is definitely, you know, in order. And Todd, I'm looking forward to your next book about the street art about George Floyd. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on to talk about this. It's been really great. I want to thank you for being on the show. The book is When They Blew the Levee, Race, Politics, and Community in Pinhook, Missouri. Thank you again. I will post the links to the documentary and also to the website and also to your new work, Todd. So thank you again for coming on, both of you.
Thank you for having us. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.